You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 13th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily. We're live here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson. Coming up in today's programme, the Attorney General makes things as clear as he can.
Let me state this clearly, colleagues. I have never met with or had any conversation with any Russians or any foreign officials concerning any type of interference with any campaign or election in the United States.
We'll look at Jeff Sessions' testimony and ask if it helped or hurt Donald Trump's position in the White House. And we'll deal with those reports that the man in charge of the investigation into claims Russia hacked the US elections could just be about to be fired. Also ahead, Macron and Merkel and Europe's rosy future, why things have taken a turn for the better in the EU. And later in the show, we examine why the co-working company WeWork works.
I think that's part of what's really cool about where we are now, is that we're kind of inventing things on the fly. The nature of our company is still a startup. I mean, we may be thought of as being big, but like, we're still figuring it all out.
We'll meet its founder, all that plus a slump at Breitbart, a celebration of South Korea, and what is Dennis Rodman doing in North Korea? That's all ahead on the Monocle Daily, live from London with me, Emma Nelson. First, though, a look at the day's other top stories. Panama has become the latest country to cut diplomatic ties with Taiwan in favour of China. The government said it would recognise there is only one China and considers Taiwan part of it. Only 20 countries have formal relations with Taiwan, which China regards as a breakaway state. The American university student Otto Warmbier, imprisoned in North Korea, has been medically evacuated from North Korea in a coma. Mr. Warmbier was sentenced to 15 years of hard labour for attempting to steal a propaganda sign from a hotel last year. According to his parents, he fell ill from botulism sometime after his trial and fell into a coma after taking a sleeping pill. The Hungarian Parliament has approved a law that imposes strict regulations on foreign-funded non-government organisations. Under the law, NGOs receiving more than €24,000 a year in donations must register as a foreign-supported organisation. Critics say the move is a crackdown on independent voices. And in Finland, the populist Finns Party parliamentary group has collapsed. 20 MPs from the party say they're now forming a new group to be known as the New Alternative. Over the weekend, the Finns Party elected a leader who's been convicted of hate speech, and it's prompted the Prime Minister to oust the group from the coalition government. And those are your headlines. And a very warm welcome to Studio One. This is Emma Nelson. Now, could Donald Trump fire the very man charged with leading the investigation into possible links between the president's campaign and Russia? Reports suggest that President Trump has had enough of Robert Mueller. The White House has expressed its surprise. Well, joining me now is Scott Lucas, Professor of International Politics at the University of Birmingham and the founder and editor of the website EA Worldview. Welcome back to the programme, Scott. Are you surprised?
I'm not surprised about the Sessions hearing at all. I am not surprised either that it may be the case that Donald Trump has asked for the removal of the special prosecutor, or will be asking for that, because quite frankly, Trump is angry, he's frustrated, he's nervous, and what we're seeing right now, because Jeff Sessions is still testifying, is an attempt, even as Sessions says, oh, I'm not stonewalling, to do exactly that, to stonewall. Whether the Trump administration can hold the line, well, they probably can't for this specific hearing, but we're only in the early stages of what's going to be a long summer, I think.
We'll get to the Jeff Sessions hearing in just a few moments' time, because there are some rather key moments which are worth a visit. But let's return to Robert Mueller. As former head of the FBI, one of the reasons that has suggested that he might be removed from his position in this investigative capacity is that there is a conflict of interest here. He comes from a law firm that represents members of the Trump family. Is that a good enough reason to get rid of him, or how uncomfortable do you think Trump is feeling about these investigations?
They're making it up as they go along, Emma. I mean, what happened is that Trump had a friend, Christopher Ruddy, who runs Newsmax, a purported news site, but more, you know, basically a cheerleading site for Trump and co. And Ruddy went in, and Trump just simply vented, and he just started to create all these reasons why Mueller might have to go. And one of them was, well, you know, he's represented me in the past. Robert Mueller was director of the FBI for 12 years, from 2001 to 2013. He's well-respected by all parties for doing an excellent job there. When he was named as the special counsel, Republicans and Democrats both welcomed that appointment. So Trump is just trying to grab any straw to set up, you know, what, you know, may be a firing of Mueller sometime down the road, when in fact he probably has little cause to do so.
One suggestion is that this is negative briefing against the White House, or indeed something that could even be coming from the White House to try to precipitate some sort of distraction from what Jeff Sessions is currently saying.
No, I just that would give credit to Donald Trump for a level of organization that doesn't exist. When Trump said this to Ruddy, yes, in the White House yesterday, he caught his communications staff off guard for about the thousandth time since he became president, and they were scrambling to create some kind of explanation. No, the conversation never happened. No, he didn't say that, et cetera. It was just another case of Trump talking off the top of his head rather than any type of attempt to think, you know, some coherent way to get themselves out of this mess.
Right. Okay. Now let's get to this hearing. The Security Intelligence Committee, having a few warm words with the Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Tell us a little bit more about your reaction to what Sessions is saying. He is basically saying that it's really a tragic strategic event that the US doesn't get along better with Russia, that he denies any kind of involvement or any knowledge of any involvement of the Russians with any part of the Trump campaign. And yet, you know him of old, don't you? How much do you trust his testimony?
I trust him about as much as a snake in the grass. I'm sorry to be blunt, but Jeff Sessions came up through Alabama judiciary and then Alabama politics, where I grew up. And Jeff Sessions is a very skillful politician, I wouldn't trust him with a coin out of my pocket. And what he has basically done today is, here's the whole summary of his testimony about whether he had any involvement in the Trump-Russia affair or whether he had any involvement in the firing of James Comey. I can't remember. I can't recall. I can't tell you. In other words, there will be nothing of substance that will come out of this today because, you know, Sessions is just simply defending or dissembling. Now, for those who defend Trump, like Fox News, they're already headlining that this is brilliant because Sessions is going after James Comey, the FBI director who was fired, and undermining his credibility. For those who are taking a wider view of things, there will be very few questions answered today, and we have to look in the next 72 hours, I think, to see where other people pop up and where other evidence pops up to sort of take apart Sessions' attempt to hold the line.
I mean, attempting to hold the line is one thing, but the stuff that we've been hearing in the last hour or so has actually made quite a few jaws drop on the editorial floor here at Monocle 24. The fact that he says that he doesn't recall discussing Syria or Russian hacking, he didn't take that many notes in many key discussions, plus the fact that not necessarily an avoidance to answer some key questions, but a choice not to answer questions just in case the President of the United States exerts his qualified his presidential privilege to redact Attorney General Sessions' statement retrospectively. Could you explain the juggling there, please,
okay,
Scott?
Well, let's pick up on a couple of things. One is that, to add to your list on specifics, probably the most extraordinary is that Sessions says, I can never recall discussing Russian interference in the 2016 election. Now, for someone who was Attorney General of the United States, before he recused himself from the investigation, to never consider this issue when the FBI is investigating it? Come on. On the wider issue, what Sessions is doing is saying, I can't tell you this or that because at some point, I don't know when, the president may invoke executive privilege. Now, executive privilege is a device by the president to say that for national security reasons, we cannot go into this matter. Now, there's no hint that Donald Trump's going to invoke that yet. When Richard Nixon did so in the 1970s over Watergate, he was unsuccessful. But once again, I come back to the core point. If Sessions ever opens up and says, well, yes, we did consider the Russian interference, if he ever says, well, yes, I did discuss matters of substance on at least two occasions when I met the Russian ambassador last year, then having admitted that there is something there, he would have to go farther. So what he's attempting to do is say, nothing here, folks, let's just move along, even though, as you say, some of that really stretches belief.
Tell me a little bit more about what Sessions' testimony will actually add to the investigation into the claims that Russia hacked the elections. It's been a delight to watch for all the wrong reasons. The jousting has been, you know, really good fun and really stimulating stuff. But how closer will we be to finding out if or when Russia got its claws into the election?
Well, you're not going to be any closer through the Sessions testimony, because the whole reason he's there is to try to basically, you know, push everything back. Why I say the next 72 hours is crucial is because the whole pattern, indeed, even before Trump became president, is a study of leaks to the media or a study of reports that just build up day by day. First of all, that Russia did definitely interfere in the 2016 election. Definitely. They hacked the computers. They tried to support Trump with damaging information about Hillary Clinton. They gave constant PR promoting Trump. It then rose to the level of, yes, there were Trump officials who did talk to Russian officials. And then it got to the point of that President Trump did try to limit the investigation directly by talking or asking FBI Director James Comey to do so. Now, that level of revelations that we've had for the last few months will continue. We'll just get more and more and more. It will follow the same pattern in that we had in Watergate, where it took 2 years between the time of the break-in for Richard Nixon to finally resign, and that never happened because Richard Nixon or any of his people said, hey, you know what, we're going to tell you everything about what happened here. Jeff Sessions isn't going to tell you anything. None of Trump's closest advisors will tell you anything. Trump is going to shout fake news. But that probably isn't going to stop the level of information that is out there and that we'll eventually get on not only that Russia interfered in the 2016 election, but that there may have been complicity of Trump and his advisors.
Scott Lucas, as ever, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. And you're with the Monocle Daily. We're live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. This is Emma Nelson, and the time in Luxembourg is 23:12. Perhaps it's the rise of Emmanuel Macron, or the inability of the far right to gain traction in Austria or the Netherlands. Or is it Brexit that's galvanised the EU to glue itself together a little closer? Whatever the reason, Europe is on the rise. Well, joining us now is Matthew Konechnik, who's Politico's chief Europe correspondent based in Berlin. Welcome to the programme. Matthew, it's not long since we were talking about, I think you and I were talking about, the end of the euro, the withdrawal of Schengen, the refugee crisis causing borders to be built up. It did look very bad for Europe not so long ago.
That's absolutely right. Things did look very, very grim just a few months ago. And it's amazing what a difference a few months can make. And in fact, part of it, I think, as well, is what you've just been talking about with everything that's gone on in the United States with Trump's election in particular. And I think the reaction that many Europeans have had to that and the fear that they've had to that. And you have seen a little bit of a backlash, or more than a little bit, a major backlash against populism in Europe in particular, obviously with the French election, the other elections that you mentioned, but also even on the local level, as we saw in Italy over the weekend with the Five Star Movement really struggling in the regional elections in Italy. So it's a pretty broad-based phenomenon that we've seen now over the past several months. And the question is, you know, can Europe really get its act together? There's sort of circumstantial evidence that we're seeing so far. But the real question, I think, is once the Brexit negotiations begin and they really start to grapple with some of these very, very sticky issues, can Europe hold together and push forward?
We've seen all these little things happen all over Europe, which is, as you say, have brought it closer together. Was there any one event that precipitated things?
Well, as I say, I do think that Trump has been really crucial in galvanizing Europeans and opening people's eyes the real dangers of populism in particular, which Europe has struggled with for a very long time. And I think the first moment you saw that was in Austria with the presidential election there, which was in December, just about a month after Trump's victory, where people saw, well, you know, it does matter if we vote or not. This can have real impact, even though it's a ceremonial position in Austria. There was this fear that this far-right party could take over the country, and you saw the same thing then, I think, in France in particular, which, you know, to many eyes was the most important election in Europe this year, and with Macron's win also in the parliamentary election, which a lot of people, you know, didn't think was going to be possible to that degree. It gives, I think, more hope than we've seen in a long time for liberals in Europe, who are hoping that there'll be some kind of big push forward for the European project, as they call it, after the German election, which is in the fall. And there'd been a lot of doubts about whether the Franco-German motor, as it were, could be restarted to really kind of push forward integration of the Eurozone in particular, but to also deal with just a lot of the simmering disputes across Europe.
Well, this is one thing that perhaps, yes, you are right, it's Emmanuel Macron. And this time last year, his party, En Marche, which became République En Marche, was barely in existence. Then he defied all odds to go and become the president. And then his parliamentary group, which didn't seem to exist about 6 weeks ago, now seems to be taking a sweeping majority. This 139-year-old man seems to be galvanizing leaders to fundamentally address the direction of Europe. And it's arguably because Macron is a man who's not afraid to talk of reform. Is this what Europe has been waiting for an awfully long time?
I think it's certainly what France has been waiting for an awfully long time. In my view, it's often a bit overdone to say, well, he's this outsider that came in, because he did come from an establishment party, and most of his supporters also come really from the mainstream, although outside those, you know, maybe old structures that a lot of people thought had outlived their usefulness. So there is this momentum behind him, and there is this sense of freshness. And if he can bring that to bear at the European level, then you really could see something fundamentally change. But it's going to have to happen very quickly. We spoke recently with Pierre Moscovici, the former French finance minister, who's now in the European Commission, who said that he sees a sort of window of opportunity here, in particular after the German election, and if Macron and Merkel can sort of lock arms on this front, and if Merkel can convince her own conservative base, to be frank, then you could see some real progress at the European level. But it's not going to be enough just for, you know, Macron alone to do this and to have that energy that he has behind him now. You really need to have a larger coming together. And that's why I say, you know, there's sort of circumstantial evidence that things have improved, but you know, we will see if there's any real meat on the bone by the end of the year, I suspect.
Matthew Carnage, Politico's chief Europe correspondent in Berlin. Thank you for joining us on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Studio One. This is The Monocle Daily and this is Emma Nelson. An American student sentenced to 15 years hard labour for the theft of a propaganda banner from a North Korean hotel has been freed from prison and is on his way home. But Otto Warmbier is reportedly in a coma, having contracted botulism shortly after his conviction. The announcement of the student's release happens to coincide with a former NBA player Dennis Rodman's third visit to North Korea, but it's been stressed that Mr. Rodman's travels were in no way related with the student's release. Well, to bring us up to date with both unusual events, John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, joins me in the studio now. Welcome to the programme, John. We never get you for anything run-of-the-mill when it comes to North Korea. That doesn't seem to exist. But let us first address this: the fate of this poor student.
Yes, not nice. Arrested on 2nd of January 2016 for stealing or trying to steal a propaganda poster from not just the hotel he was staying in, but the staff-only area of that hotel. He was at somewhere we shouldn't have been. And he stole the poster in full view of the hotel security cameras, perhaps not the cleverest thing to do. His trial lasted less than an hour, sentenced to 15 years. I mean, that was bad enough. But it's emerged in the last week that he contracted botulism, say the North Koreans, soon after that trial, and was given a sleeping pill which put him into a coma for a year. It must have been a very, very strong sleeping pill.
How much do we believe of this?
Probably not a great deal. Did he have botulism? Perhaps he did. But botulism does not induce a coma. You do not get a coma from any single sleeping pill, no matter how strong. A coma occurs either after quite different medical conditions or through continued dosing of coma-inducing medication, which, of course, Western medicine uses in certain specified circumstances. His family only learned last week that he was in this condition, were naturally horrified. The US government, it turns out, knew just a little bit earlier. The Americans and the North Koreans had an unofficial meeting in Oslo in Norway 2 or 3 weeks ago now, where famously the North Koreans said that they would never relinquish their nuclear weapons. But that's another story. They also finally agreed that the Swedish embassy in Pyongyang, who cover the United States consular interests, because of course there is no US embassy in Pyongyang, should finally have consular access to Warmbier. The Swedes went and saw him, reported the state he was in, and the Americans, of course, were furious. Joseph Yun, who is the State Department's point man on North Korea, speaking to the North Korean ambassador to the United Nations, made clear that this man had to come out now on medical grounds.
The story you tell is one of diplomatic intricacy. What will this event lead to in terms of the communication channels between North Korea and, let's say, the rest of the world?
Probably,
how will that change it?
I don't think it will change it at all. I think, the intricacy is even more complex than I sketched out. Firstly, I suspect that what happened was that Warmbier was being held by one or other of the North Korean security agencies, and it was not until the Swedes intervened that the North Korean Foreign Ministry discovered what was going on. North Koreans don't talk amongst themselves, let alone to the outside world. And of course, when they found out, the Foreign Ministry would have realised the potential for horrible embarrassment for North Korea, particularly if he died on them, and would have taken immediate steps to get him out.
Arguably, and I'm not for one second advocating this, but it is easier to discuss or to make up a story about someone who has died than it is for someone who is clearly in need of urgent medical attention. The fact is that there is a possibility that Mr. Warmbier will one day wake up and then everybody will hear about what happened.
Yes, I think the chances are that Mr. Warmbier will wake up, that quite soon we will hear his side of the story. Explaining a death away is probably easier than a year's coma. But remember that he had formally been sentenced. He was nominally in a North Korean labour camp. It turns out to be in a one-man labour camp, not quite what you expect. Yes, they built it especially for him. Thoughtful, wasn't it? But he was formally, therefore, in North North Korean custody, and the North Koreans therefore were formally responsible for him. Being a prisoner has that one very small advantage. You're raising eyes at his one-man labour camp. Yes, a very strange arrangement. Sentenced to 15 years of labour camp, as you know, but they weren't going to let him go and associate with other ordinary North Korean labour camp inmates, of whom there are a great number. Instead, they set aside a couple of rooms for him, deemed that these were his labour camp, and put him in there. Although, of course, if he's been in a coma for a year, he won't have noticed that.
He won't have noticed that, having contracted botulism. While all this is taking place, we have the former NBA player Dennis Rodman being filmed at Beijing Airport, saying that he is hoping that his visit to Pyongyang will achieve the things that I'm sure his president Donald Trump would like to have achieved. Rodman is no stranger to North Korea, is he?
No, he's been there. I think this is his third visit. He has played to Kim Jong-un's fascination with basketball, and he's actually played in front of the great man. But whether he actually had any hand in the release of Otto Warmbier, I think, is open to all kinds of doubt. I suspect it's more likely that his visit to Pyongyang was either just a fluke — flukes happen even in North Korea — or it was the North Koreans trying to deflect attention from something that might have embarrassed them badly. The visit that was almost certainly more important in getting Warmbier released was that of Joseph Yun himself, as I said, the US State Department's point man on North Korea, who was there on Monday, and who, by all accounts, made very clear to the North Koreans face-to-face that he was not going to leave without Warmbier.
What kind of relationship can Rodman... How useful is Dennis Rodman in all this?
Probably not very useful at all. I mean, I think it's interesting that he, a man not noticed for excessive modesty, has played down his role in this. He's said he just wants to get sporting exchanges going with North Korea. He's hinted that he's spoken to President Trump, but that's the kind of thing that Rodman says. It may or may not be true. And I suspect, as I say, that the real work was done by Joseph Yun, and that Rodman was just a bit of flash to cover it all.
A little bit of a distraction.
That's right.
John Everard, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. Donald Trump became president of the United States, the name Breitbart suddenly started getting more attention. The right-wing news website's founder, Steve Bannon, appeared at the president's side, appointed his top advisor. We all held our noses and got to know more about America's alt-right as a consequence. It was in the full expectation that this was the kind of narrative we should expect from the White House. But instead of taking hold, Breitbart's popularity seems to have slipped. Ad revenues at the website have plummeted. We're joined now by Pete Vernon, a fellow at the Columbia Journalism Review in New York. Welcome to the programme. Pete joins us from our bureau in New York. Pete, explain to us just how much of a presence Breitbart was occupying at the time Donald Trump came to power.
I think Breitbart really represented the most visible media property in the Trump ascendancy. They were not the biggest by any means. Fox News on the conservative side still reaches many, many more people. But because Breitbart was one of the first to support Donald Trump, and because there were such close ties between what are now former members of Breitbart and the Trump campaign, it was seen as the driving media force behind the Trump campaign.
So I remember a lot of us were exploring and doing explainers on what the alt-right are, but by all accounts, ad revenues at Breitbart since March the 31st have declined, or the number of advertisers, I should say, on the Breitbart website has declined by 90%. What has prompted not just a decline, but a plummet?
I mean, there's a couple different things going on there. One is the audience has dropped, right? Since the election, a lot of different news sites have seen audience drop off, which makes sense in terms of interest, but right-wing sites have seen an even steeper drop. The other issue going on there is advertiser boycotts. There are a few different activist groups in the U.S. that have drawn attention to some of Breitbart's more racist, misogynist content, and have essentially encouraged their audiences to get in contact with major companies who used to advertise on Breitbart those companies have then pulled their ads. So as you mentioned, according to a Digiday report, that there were only 26 brands on Breitbart in May, down from a high of 242 in March.
In the meantime, there have been accusations that the Breitbart website itself is no longer the firebrand destination for the alt-right that it may well have been a few months ago. There are suggestions that its output has been moderated, that it's cooling things down, and that their reporters' words as well are not quite as full of vitriol as they were a few months ago.
Yeah, I think there's something of an identity crisis at Breitbart. They are now a member of the White House press corps, at least temporarily. They haven't gotten permanent credentials yet. But they have this candidate that they supported who is now the president. And they've gone from the outside to the most insider publication in some ways. And they've struggled to adapt to that. It's a lot easier to be throwing rocks and kind of using incendiary language when you're on the outside looking in. They just haven't figured out yet how to adjust their brand to being in power.
As a result of the decline of popularity of Breitbart, is there any sign that actually the whole alt-right movement itself is weakening in power?
You know, it's tough to measure what the alt-right actually is or was. There are a number of different kind of ideologies that fell under that umbrella or agreed with parts of what the quote-unquote alt-right represented. We don't really have any sort of measurement, right? It's not a political party. It's a fringe movement within the conservative right-wing ideology. And so, yes, is there less kind of vitriol and anger coming from Breitbart? I think that's fair to say. Whether that reflects a lessening of those passions within the electorate as a whole is something that we just don't know right now.
Pete Vernon from the Columbia Journalism Review in New York. Thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. Now, WeWork is a New York-based startup that builds shared workspaces for startups and other people around the world. Since it launched in 2010, the company's built more than 180 office locations in almost 50 cities around the world. It's now worth $17 billion. Well, in a preview of our weekly business programme, The Entrepreneurs, we hear from the co-founder of that company, Miguel McKelvey. He spoke to our very own Daniel Giacopelli.
Our goal from the start was always to support people, you know, following their passion, their dream, and really figure out how do we do that in a multidimensional way. And so when we started, I think the easiest market was, you know, the entrepreneur, the startup, the small business who was already, you could follow their path or sort of help them along on that path because they're small and they're easier to relate to and deal with. And also, you know, we celebrate them as a culture, I think. So they're kind of like a cool market to partner with and to be a part of. On the enterprise side, though, the challenge is the same, right? Like, we want people to walk into their workplace every day with a feeling of positivity and happiness and excitement. And so when we saw them coming to us, like, people were coming. I mean, whether, you know, everything from pharmaceutical companies to, you know, larger tech companies to, you know, big consultancies, they're coming and saying, you know, hey, we want space.
So they came to you and knocked on your door and say, hey, why don't you do something for people like us?
Of course. And I think what happened in the beginning was they were, you know, thinking of it as like an outpost. Like, we saw, you know, the 10 person, the 15, the 20, which would be, say, a small group who perhaps had a singular purpose. And I think that, you know, it built on that. And I think a lot of times it would be a creative division, a tech division in a larger company, an innovation division, who's saying, how do we get outside of the normal framework in order to think differently, work differently? And then I think that just kind of kept building on itself. And, you know, it went from the 20 person to the 40 person to the 60 to the 100, and now up to the 500s and 600s, you know, where we're at now.
Yeah, so Microsoft is a big one too, right? They came to you guys in New York City, and they wanted to house a few hundred of their sales employees in buildings across New York?
Well, Les Howes, in their case, they do have a good size HQ in the city. And so more what they were looking for is a flexible solution. So when their team members are, you know, traveling throughout the city, meeting with different clients, rather than always having to go back to HQ, to have like a flexible place to drop in, you know, in between time or, you know, say closer to home, and just to have a much more flexible solution. I think that's part of what's really cool about where we are now, is that we're kind of inventing things on the fly, you know, because I mean, the nature of our company is still a startup, and we may be thought of as being big, but like, we're still figuring it all out and figuring out how we can serve, you know, our members. And so that was something that, you know, through conversation, we developed something which could be sort of productized, you know. And so that's what a lot of the conversations are, is like, okay, what do you need? How can we help you? And then in our minds, we're thinking, well, if it works for you, it's going to work for somebody else too.
I mean, that makes up a fifth of your members right now, these big guys.
A fifth and growing, definitely the largest sort of, you know, growth. Yeah. And that makes sense, just because there are so many big companies out there, and so many who are, you know, facing similar challenges. Definitely, you know, they need to compete. So for talent, they need cool and good and inspiring, positive work environments. And then they also, you know, shift towards urban locations. So many companies who did, you know, suburban office space now need city close locations to transportation. Obviously, people are really sensitive to that, and they don't want to commute out to the suburbs. So we can help solve that problem. And then I think, you know, on the culture side, there has been somewhat of an awakening. You know, I think people are feeling like they need to do more for their team members in order to make them feel happy and satisfied. And hopefully we're a part of that solution. I mean, we still hope that, like, you know, the 20, 30, 40,000 person company is thinking of that holistically for their entire workforce. But it's also cool what with the portions of their workforce that they, you know, share with us.
Yeah, we'll talk about kind of how the workplace is changing a bit later. But I mean, what was the business case for you guys to focus on this, as opposed to the startups? Because I would assume these big corporations, the contracts are probably on a longer basis, right, than the startups who might go out of business next week.
Yeah, some. I mean, for us, there's definitely, you could say, some security in having relationships with bigger companies. But at the same time, in a relative sense, we're still trying to be super flexible for them. I mean, part of our value proposition is that we are flexible. And so, you know, we never want to be like compared to sort of traditional real estate solutions. So the timeframes may be longer. And for them, on their side, they want more, you know, they need to sort of set things in place for a longer period of time. But our value proposition is still about flexibility. It's still about how can you grow? You know, how can you take the space that you need and then add more later? How can you downsize it if and when you need to? And then, you know, how, if you are working on other solutions, how can we be a component of it rather than the only solution? But from a business perspective, I mean, certainly everyone, you know, there's credibility in having big Fortune 100 companies as customers. Absolutely.
Are you worried, though, that the kind of startup soul will get pushed away with the bigger guys?
No, because I think, you know, we're not bending our product to them. I mean, they're really coming to us because they want this environment that, I mean, there's plenty of other solutions for them if they want something normal in workspace, right? So the only reason to come to us is if you're looking for that spirit, that energy, that vibe. Now, that said, we're still at the beginning of this adventure, right? So, I mean, we still have to figure out how to cultivate our relationships with these companies and their HR, their, you know, their people teams and their facilities people, to really make sure that we're working together and that it's a collaborative, you know, exercise in finding the right solutions.
And you work with them for design and construction and stuff too. I mean, do they ever want to do something that you might not want to do? I mean, how collaborative is it? Because you probably have a really good idea of what works and what doesn't, and they might not, because they have, you know, they're a singular case.
Well, every company does, of course, have their own internal culture. And then depending on the teams that they are bringing into the space, there might be different needs. I would say one of the biggest challenges is privacy, because certainly, I mean, in a normal WeWork space, you know, we're adamant that like all the walls are glass and you're not going to be able to cover them. There are some compliance issues. You know, we'll have like companies that have specific areas of their business that just have to be private, you know, for regulatory reasons. And so there we have to work with them on privacy, and we'll figure out how to plan a space so that that has as little impact as possible. But what's been awesome is that we've had some companies that come in and they're just like, there's no way. We're not exposing our company to all your other members. We want, you know, if we're going to come, we have to, you know, cover up the glass. And we're like, look, we think it's the greater good for your team and for the whole community if you stay open and connected. And we've had some really good wins where people came in with that idea and they did say, okay, we'll give it a shot, we'll try it, and it's worked out really well.
And hasn't it just? Miguel McKelvey, co-founder of WeWork, in conversation with Daniel Giacopelli. If you enjoyed that, well, you can hear the full interview on The Entrepreneurs tomorrow, or today, depending on where you are in the world, at 1900 London time on Monocle 24. Coming up on The Daily, a review of the Asian newspapers.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer, or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back, and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Join us as we discover the developers who are rethinking the property world, how you can build stores that work in a click-and-shop world, what the most inspirational entrepreneurs are planning, how you make a hit restaurant or fragrance firm, the media brands to watch, how we can green our cities, the future of transport, and much more besides. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
Time is 5:41 a.m. in Beijing, 22:41 here in London. Time now to find what's making the front pages in Asia. And I'm delighted to say Michael Buhler from the Department of Politics and International Studies at SOAS, the University of London, has joined me in the studio to do just that. Welcome back to the studio, Michael. Good to see you. What are we starting with?
I wrote you a story from Jakarta about urban planning or the lack of it in the capital of Indonesia. The story written by an Indonesian academic who basically shows how if you are rich in Jakarta, then spatial planning and planning laws do not really mean all that much for you. However, if you're poor, the government will come for you.
Okay, what is the example? Tell us about one of these oligarchs who seem to be doing what they please.
Well, there's, for instance, the Lippo Group, which is an infamous developer in Jakarta, politically well-connected, has connections to the current government, but then also had connections to the former dictator of Indonesia, Suharto, and is responsible for having really paved over one of Indonesia's Jakarta's green spaces and basically what was supposed to be a recreational area is now an area where luxury apartments have been built.
It is what 18% of those what they're describing in the newspaper as a middle class population can afford to purchase or rent their own apartments. Is it really that small?
Astonishingly, in Jakarta, actually, rental property is actually quite expensive, and therefore, of course, poor people are further and further pushed out, which then increases, of course, traffic as well in the city. Now, what's also interesting in Jakarta is that basically developers are usually not responsible for public infrastructure, so you can build a huge apartment building, but then basically not actually build any road to and from it. And so that has created a lot of problems in the city.
Indeed it does. And what exactly are the Indonesian authorities doing about that?
Well, not really all that much. They're now basically discussing whether they should relocate Jakarta to central Borneo and build a capital from scratch. But of course, what we see in Jakarta is a testament to government incompetence. And so, of course, therefore, they probably would come up with a similar city in central Borneo in a couple of years from now.
Indeed. And there's at the end of this article, there has been violations of planning regulations, especially conducted by developers. The Jakarta provincial government seems to approve of it. There's no reply from the Jakarta provincial government to come back with it, but it says that green areas intended to be a catchment area have deteriorated as developments have been made. As a result, water inundates suburbs every rainy season. It's not a good state of affairs, is it?
Yeah, because no, it's basically sinking into the ground at the rate of 4 to 6 centimetres per year, which is, of course, a problem.
Okay, let us move on to the Asia Times. Shadowy rebels extend Myanmar's wars.
So this is interesting because we have, of course, talked quite a bit about these problems in Burma with the Muslim population in Rakhine State. Now, an army has now emerged, the Arakan Army, which basically seems to fight for independence of Rakhine State. And this article is about the origins of that army and what their demands are.
Okay, tell us a little bit more about what these demands are and whether anyone's actually going to reply to them.
So basically, it's been established in April 2009, but has become increasingly powerful over the last couple of years. Now, apparently, it has about 1,500 fighters under arms and basically wants to liberate Rakhine State from Buddhist fascism, as they say. And the central government, of course, now increasingly concerned because one of their promises was, of course, that they would pacify these peripheral areas as they would enter these peace negotiations with Aung San Suu Kyi. And so that doesn't seem to have happened.
Indeed, the Asia Times is reporting that this alliance has stepped up operations against government targets. Where do you see this going next?
The article here says that they finance themselves through the jade mines and the drug trade. And so probably, as with all other ethnic insurgencies in Burma, there will have to be some sort of a ceasefire capitalism here, that basically the Burmese central government promises these rebels something in return for giving up their arms. And so I would assume that at least the rebel leaders will get a cut of the illegal economy that they already seem to be involved in.
But at the heart of this, though, I mean, we have the how's it been described? The rehabilitation of Myanmar Burma when it was brought back in when the junta went. What seems to be happening here is that in this case in particular, it says that there's been an awful lot of internal displacement because of this fighting. And international and national relief operations, according to the Asia Times, have been supplementing and basically going to the humanitarian rescue of hundreds of thousands of people. Surely when you get that kind of situation in a country, which ostensibly is opening up to the world, what traction, what pressure do foreign governments have to say, look, sort this out, because we're not going to go in and rescue your own humanitarian crisis?
Very little. I mean, even Aung San Suu Kyi has actually been quite silent about this conflict in Rakhine State because, of course, she's in a very difficult position as well. If she says something in support of a minority religious group, then she will be attacked by military commanders. If she does not support these minority groups of a different religious minority, that's important here, she will be under attack as well. And so there's not much support from her either. And now, of course, all surrounding governments have very little interest in these conflicts to escalate. I mean, there's a mention here that basically a couple of thousand people have fled to India because of this conflict. And so I guess they feel as long as the government keeps it under control, no matter how, they're probably going to intervene as little as possible.
Okay, let's move on to the Southeast Asian news. From pride to ruin, how a once thriving train factory in Vietnam has faded from glory.
Yeah, interesting story. Apparently, Vietnam's oldest and only train factory is close to bankruptcy because Vietnam's emerging middle class prefers to take low-cost airplanes.
Goodness me, tell us more.
So basically, the company has been around since 1905. It was established by the French when they controlled the territory that was then known as Indochina, and has then been quite successful because, of course, also of the war economy in Vietnam for the next couple of decades. Apparently, its heydays were in the 1990s, and since output has dropped by 90% because no one takes the train anymore. Apparently, as it says here, last year 31 million people traveled by air compared to 11 million people by train.
Which is an astonishing thought, isn't it? And given the fact that, I mean, this is not just happening in Vietnam.
No.
Explain, just, you know, it's been well documented on Monocle 24, but the low-cost airline is now the equivalent of the bus.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the difference here is to other countries that basically Vietnam had actually a very good train system. If you go to the Philippines or Indonesia, of course, they never really had one. And so therefore, the damage is less obvious. But of course, Vietnam, it seems the only way to salvage the train industry is actually to now turn this into a luxury kind of travel means of transport. And so basically the rail minister says that he wants to now basically open that up for foreign tourists, but whether that's a good strategy, I'm not so sure.
Indeed, it says some companies are seeking to revive the colonial romance of rail travel, offering first-class trips, wood-lined cabins with restaurant cars. That'd be a very, very nice thing to see. Michael Bueller, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. Finally, on today's programme, we head to South Korea. Michael Breen first visited the country back in 1982 as a correspondent, and now he lives in Seoul. In his latest book, The New Koreans, The Business, History and People of South Korea, Mr. Breen compiles a history of a country that changed immensely since he first arrived there. While in London to talk about his latest book, he spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
I first went there 35 years ago. My plan at the time was to be a freelance reporter. And I went to Korea almost on a whim. I didn't mentally unpack my suitcase for about 5 years. So there was never any intention to stay very long. And then I just ended up staying. I kind of fell in love with the place. From a journalistic career point of view, it might have been better if I'd gone to Hong Kong, because Hong Kong was a big news center and Korea was always a bit on the edge. That's how I started there. So there was no plan. I didn't know anything about the place, except the other Korea was communist. That's about all I knew.
I think it's very difficult to find another country that saw such changes because, you know, South Korea, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but about 50 years ago, it was quite an impoverished country. But then, you know, nowadays, you know, they have a very strong GDP, high quality of life as well.
Yeah.
They have their own kind of Silicon Valley. So did you see this transformation?
Well, I did. I saw parts of it. And this type of transformation is quite exciting. And it's something that has been happening and is happening at different paces all over the world. The beauty of it for me, particularly for any reporter, is the South Korean change was so rapid that you see it happening in front of you. I think in other countries, like in Britain, for example, the change was much slower. So you get used to things. In Korea, you're just about to get used to something, boom, it's changed again. I think the only other country that could be compared to is, in terms of speed, is Taiwan. The Taiwanese and the Koreans sort of developed around the same pace, with the Taiwanese slightly ahead of the Koreans for a while. But already by the time when I went there in 1982, the economic growth was about 15 years old. But already the transformation was visible. And already they were talking about, you know, the miracle of economic growth. And then other things come out, you know, that continues. But then politics changes as a result of economics. You get a growing middle class, and then they start to demand freedoms. With a lot of money around, then culture starts to get supported, and so that leads to even more change. Because it's happened all so quickly, you just see it. I mean, you look back and think, well, 2 years ago, that wasn't happening.
South Korea is well known for being an economic powerhouse, but also a cultural powerhouse in Asia. It's funny because even here at Monocle 24, we play a lot of K-pop.
Oh, really?
It's in our playlist. And, you know, of course, you know, they have incredible film industry as well.
Yeah.
So the thing that was quite important as well to, you know, to show South Korea's image to the world.
When I first went there, foreign experts and Korean experts never really predicted, oh, you know, we're really changing, this is going to happen. It always, the expert's attitude was always, this is basically as far as it gets. And if the government announced some new plan, oh, we're going to go into electronics, it's like, oh, well, that won't work. And if anyone had said, even 20 years ago, you know, one day Korean pop stars will be loved around the world, or Korean movies are going to be a big thing, you'd sort of go, oh, come on, give us a break. And you'd have a lot of evidence. The more expert they are, the better the argument you could make. So all of these things are so surprising to not just to outsiders, but to Koreans themselves.
What's the relationship of South Korea and North Korea? Did you see changes during the period you were there?
Yes and no. What hasn't changed is North Korea. These two countries, by the way, Korea existed as an independent entity roughly along its current borders for about 1,300 years. Then, beginning of the 20th century, they were taken over by the Japanese. So they had 35 years of where they lost their independence. And then the end of World War II, they were split into two. There's a real rivalry there that each side thinks it's the real Korea. If you go to North Korea, they refer to their country as Korea. If you go to South Korea, they're both arguing on the world stage, we're the real Korea. Now, we all know that who's won and who's lost. You know, really, it's over. The problem is the North Koreans or the North Korean government cannot admit and then do what it has to do. So that part hasn't really changed. What has changed is the attitude of South Koreans to the North Koreans. A generation ago, particularly because people remembered the war, the Civil War, the South Koreans, they're kind of socialistic in a way, but they're very anti-communist. But gradually they started to lighten up. As their country became more democratic, they became more generous-spirited towards the North Koreans. They thought, okay, if we're nice to them, they'll be nice to us, but they weren't. So they tried to engage the North Koreans to give without expecting anything back, giving aid and help and so on. And they just got spat in the face, basically. So there's right now, South Koreans are kind of indifferent. There's a cynicism and a lack of interest in North Korea now.
I believe the new president is a bit more diplomatic towards North Korea as well.
Right.
But I just want to see your opinion on this.
That's right. I mean, one of the main differences between, say, conservative and liberal, Labour, if you like, in the Korean context is the attitude to North Korea. So the conservatives are much more cautious and don't want to waste their time talking to them because they're not going to get anywhere. The liberals, and we now have a liberal president coming, mm-hmm. believe in engagement. He wants to engage the North Koreans. You know, the conservatives aren't opposed to engagement for no good reason. In other words, if we see engagement with the North Koreans, it'll prompt newspaper stories and a bit of excitement, but it won't lead to anything serious. So this sort of attitude swings back and forth, or the political policy swings back and forth.
What's been your favorite thing about living in South Korea? What's so special about it, especially after such a long time, looking back?
You know, as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm British. Mm-hmm. So when I left Britain, I sort of came from a generation that was slightly, a bit of magic dust was sprinkled on us from the hippies, a little bit idealistic. But at the same time, we're British, so we're kind of cynical. If someone expresses an ambition, a young person says, oh, I want to be the prime minister, all his friends say, what, you? You know, there's a kind of a cynicism and a putting down of people. When I went to Korea, I found the Koreans so energized. And you meet young people, like you meet a sort of a 13-year-old who's taking violin lessons, and she says, I want to be the best violin player in the world. And you're waiting for sort of the wink, wink, and it's not there. These people are really serious about, you know, going to the top. That sort of bounces back. When you live amongst that, it affects you. I wouldn't say it purifies you, but it takes away some of your cynicism. So there's something very wholesome and very inspiring about being among the Koreans.
That was Michael Breen, author of The New Koreans, The Business, History and People of South Korea, in conversation here at Midori House with Fernanda Augusto-Pacheco. The book is out now. That's all we have time for today's edition of The Monocle Daily. My thanks to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, researchers Yolene Goffin and Fiammata Chazana. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. The Globalist is here in 8 hours' time. Your host for that will be Georgina Godwin. Top story will be Hungary approving strict regulations to foreign-funded NGOs. Our guest Adam Labor will be in the studio. Plus, we'll be getting business in the Balkans from Guy Delorne, and we'll be finding out what's happening at Pitti Uomo in Florence. Our man Jamie Waters and our lady Chiara Remella will be talking to us live from Florence. The Globalist, that is happening at 7 a.m. London time. The Monocle Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Hope you can join me for that. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.